Hello and welcome to volume 44, number 30 of your weekly local news magazine, Grapevine. Brought to you by the Great Yarmouth and District Talking Newspaper Association, this edition is published on Friday the 26th of July, 2024. I'm Graham, your presenter, joined this week by newsreader Andrew. And in this week's issue, a company faces a £3 million fine for a fatal harbour accident. The Waterways has a new sculpture trail. The murder trial continues for the St. Peter's Road killing. And did you realise that skinny dipping wasn't illegal? In addition, trading standards have some advice on scammers. And was Gorson once beset by druids? All this coming your way during the next hour or so. But with no birthdays this week, it's straight over to Andrew for some news.
Hello everybody and welcome to Grapevine for another week. It's Andrew with you again. I'm pleased to say I brought the sunshine with me today, so hopefully by the time you're hearing this, it's still with you as well. Let's start with some news. And closed-circuit television shows the moment a large piece of metal pipework fell while two men were decommissioning a North Sea gas rig. Stephen Picken was cutting the rig with a colleague from a cherry picker in Great Yarmouth Outer Harbour when the metal fell and struck the platform, catapulting the men off. Mr. Picken, from Stoke-on-Trent, who specialised in cutting metal with oxypropane equipment and was described as the best in the country, died at the scene, while his colleague Mark Kumar survived but suffered life-changing injuries. Viola Environmental Services UK Limited, which employed the two men, admitted failing to ensure their health and safety at work. The incident happened on the morning of October the 17th, 2019, when Mr. Picken was dismantling part of an oil rig. A metal column toppled to the ground, hitting the platform on the way, and throwing the men to the ground from 40 to 45 feet in the air. At a sentencing hearing at Ipswich Crown Court, Judge Martin Livett said it was a foreseeable accident that could have been avoided. There were several failings which fell far short of the standards recognised in the decommissioning industry, he said. Previously, the court heard that no cutting plans had been produced for the work being undertaken to show where, how, and at what angle to make cuts during the demolition. The judge fined Viola £3 million and ordered it to pay costs of £60,000. After the hearing, Health and Safety Executive Inspector David King said, "This incident in an emerging industry highlights the level of controls required to safely demolish what are large, dangerous structures. Viola did not meet these standards, and tragically one life was lost and another forever changed. The Health and Safety Executive's mission is to protect people and places, and organisations that endanger their employees by failing to meet the required standards should be aware that we will not hesitate to take appropriate enforcement action." Great Yarmouth's new bridge, costing £121 million and that hit the headlines due to mechanical problems after opening, has scooped a national award despite the issues. The Herring Bridge, which opened on February the 1st, has been named as Road Bridge of the Year at the new Civil Engineer Bridges Award. The award comes despite some opening issues when it became dubbed as the Swearing Bridge after a control room blunder saw a volley of expletives played out on loudspeakers to motorists waiting to cross. The teething issues continued when the town's new third crossing became stuck again for nearly a week due to a fault with a sensor on the bridge's locking mechanism. Despite this, the judges were still impressed with the project that beat 175 other submissions for the award. Speaking about Herring Bridge, the event compere said, "The judges found this project to be a very impressive and interesting scheme. The project demonstrated an impressive scheme under challenging conditions, meeting time and budget targets. It featured a well-structured approach with clear coverage of the judging criteria and significant attention to minimising carbon impacts." And Norfolk's £3 billion tourism industry is in line for a massive boost through a new drive to unlock millions of pounds of Westminster money. Council leaders say a new partnership will give Norfolk and Suffolk access to pots of cash which the counties could not previously bid for. And they hope the newly obtained Local Visitor Economy Partnership, known as an LVEP, which has been obtained in conjunction with the Visit East of England, will boost jobs in an industry crucial for the economy of the counties. Norfolk County Council leader Kay Mason-Billig said, "The influence of tourism on our county is immense in terms of jobs and economic impact, and the new partnership promises to increase investment into Norfolk and raise our profile nationally and internationally." Norfolk's tourism industry is worth £3 billion, employing 70,000 people at peak season, including in coastal areas like North Norfolk and Great Yarmouth. Changes in the criteria the Government and Tourist Board Visit England used to award money to boost tourism meant a new partnership needed to be created so the maximum amount of cash can be obtained. Norfolk was one of the few remaining areas in England without an LVEP, with Cornwall, Yorkshire, London and the Peak District all enjoying the status awarded by National Tourism Agency Visit England. The status will mean the Norfolk and Suffolk partnership will be able to bid for government cash, which was previously off limits, and that could boost tourism centres like Great Yarmouth, Cromer, Sheringham, Hunstanton and the Broads. To reinforce the application, Visit East of England received many letters of support, including from Lord Leicester of Holcombe, the Broads Authority, Norwich International Airport, Greater Anglia, National Tourist Trust East, English Heritage, Transport East, and businesses such as Rowden-based English Distillery and the Maidshead Hotel in Norwich. County Hall officers said if the visitor economy grows at the same level as over the past decade, and with the help of government funding, that would create 9,700 further jobs connected to tourism. Fabian Eagle, the Conservative-controlled Council's Cabinet Member for Economic Growth, said, "The Norfolk visitor economy is worth more than £3 billion a year and is one of our key industry sectors, accounting for nearly 20% of all jobs in the county. A successful local visitor economy partnership will help us grow the sector even further and support high-quality jobs." A 19-year-old man has been charged with a voyeurism offence after being caught filming a child in a public toilet in Great Yarmouth. Police received a report on Wednesday that a young girl, under the age of 13, had been filmed when a mobile phone was placed under the cubicle wall of a public toilet in a supermarket near Vauxhall Station. Following inquiries, Alfie Walker, age 19, of Regent Street in Northampton, was arrested on July the 19th in Northampton and taken to King's Lynn Police Investigation Centre for questioning. Walker was charged with voyeurism, an offence where someone gets sexual pleasure from watching, photographing or recording others doing something that's usually private without their permission. He was remanded to appear at Norwich Magistrate Court on Monday. A new bid to demolish a vacant pub and build three homes in its place in Fritton Village is still awaiting a decision. The Decoy Tavern on Beccles Road in Fritton would be knocked down if the applicant, Brian Newson, got permission to do so from Great Yarmouth Borough Council. Plans show three detached homes would be constructed in its place. The plans come just a year after the same applicant lost an appeal to demolish the historic building. In a report, the planning inspector last year said the facilities offered by the pub, quote, should be retained to serve the needs of the local community. Several villagers had objected to previous plans, with some saying the Decoy Tavern was the heart of the village. One resident said knocking down the building would be a tragic loss, while another wanted the village to buy the venue as a community asset. A pub has been on the site since 1841 and has variously been named Pot in Hand and Bird in Hand, and the nearest other pub is the Bell at St Olive's, just short of 1 mile away. If you wanted to have a look at the plans in full, you can search under the reference number 06/24/0247/F in Great Yarmouth Borough Council's planning portal. A dog wearing a dirty muzzle has been found tied to a post after being abandoned. The male German Shepherd was discovered sitting alone on concrete ground, leashed to a metal gate and wearing a muzzle. He was found by passers-by in Martham on Thursday, who contacted the Animal Warden Services, and a warden visited the site and the dog was then taken into care of the local council. With no tag or information about the owner, it is unknown how long the dog had been tied to the post or why he was abandoned. Spokesman for Yarmouth Council said, "We received reports on Thursday, July the 11th, that a German Shepherd dog had been found tied to a post in Martham. Our contractor, Animal Warden Services, retrieved the dog and it is currently being cared for in kennels. If anyone has any information about the animal, they are asked to telephone our contractor on 01493 800 697, and investigations into the incident are still ongoing." Now, following a rocky start, a bid to open a new bar in Ormsby St Margaret is gathering support among villagers. The owners of East Norfolk Cider, an award-winning brewery based in Scrapby, want to open a tap room in the neighbouring village of Ormsby. The original application prompted concern among some villagers that the bar could become a noise nuisance. But Russell Watson, who runs the brewery, has revised the plans and confirmed the venue would open from 12 p.m. to 8 p.m. Sunday to Wednesday and 12 p.m. to 9 p.m. Thursday to Saturday. Following the revisions, Ormsby with Scrapby Parish Council dropped their objection to the plans. The application has also received support from two villagers who say the bar would be, quote, "a great addition to the parish." And one said, "I'm sure Mr. Watson will manage it very well and ensure those living close by will not be disrupted." The bar will be called the Butcher's Tap Room and showcase the brewery's own cider and apple juice, as well as selling a selection of local ales, spirits and wine, and hot drinks and snacks. The proposed location is on Wapping, in a former estate agent's Town and Country, which closed down in September last year. The original plans were facing objections from some 14 residents who raised concerns about the potential impacts of noise from the bar. In a letter to planning officials sent on July the 14th, Mr. Watson outlined measures the bar would use for reducing noise. These would include signs asking customers to respect residents when leaving the premises and the door remaining closed while the premises are open. Our target customers are people that appreciate locally produced small batch breweries and distilleries, which are not available in the larger group tied public houses, Mr. Watson said. Ormsby, of course, once had three public houses and now only has one, the Farmers on West Road. A new £88 million electronic system designed to help Norfolk's three main hospitals work better together has taken a big step forward. Local health bosses are investing the sum in a new electronic patient record, called EPR, to be used at the Norfolk Norwich, the James Paget in Gorleston and the Queen Elizabeth Hospital in King's Lynn. Once introduced, the record system aims to eliminate over-reliance on paper-based records and vastly improve communication between the three hospitals. The system, which is planned to launch in 2026, will then mean that information can be easily shared between the sites when a patient has to be transferred for specialist care. Currently, when hospitals need to share information, records have to be physically transferred, which can cause delays in treatment or force patients to repeat their stories multiple times. However, under the EPR, staff will be able to access information electronically. Alice Webster, Chief Executive of the Queen Elizabeth Hospital, said, "This transformative initiative will empower our healthcare professionals to deliver exceptional patient care by providing them with accurate, up-to-date and easily accessible patient information. We believe this investment in digital innovation will greatly enhance our ability to meet the needs of our community now and in the future. By eliminating the reliance on paper-based records and multiple disparate systems, the EPR will enhance coordination and collaboration among clinicians, nurses and other healthcare staff, resulting in improved continuity of care for our patients." Ian Riley, Director of Digital and Data for NHS Norfolk and Waveney, said, "One of our ambitions as an integrated care system is to make sure that people only need to tell their story once. This new EPR system will give staff better access to patient information, ensuring better, faster and safer care to Norfolk and Waveney residents. People who have lost their houses to coastal erosion are to get more help through a new scheme that could help them start their lives again in a new home. Great Yarmouth Borough Council has approved a new climate adaptation policy which aims to better prepare for the future along the vast stretch of vulnerable coastline between Winchester-on-Sea and Hopton. The authority will seek to use the £8.4 million Resilient Coast Project cash awarded by the Environment Agency to implement schemes aimed at helping communities adapt to the threat of erosion. Carl Smith, leader of Great Yarmouth Borough Council, said, "Given the limited national funding available, we needed to create a policy that enables the council to devise tailored responses for those affected that address their unique needs. Under the plans, Yarmouth Council will use a range of actions to help people who have lost their homes, such as buying land and homes outside of risk zones for people to relocate to, purchasing at-risk properties and land, and offering properties to rent through its council-owned housing company." Following the decision, Trevor Wainwright, leader of the Labour opposition group at Yarmouth Borough Council, said, "This policy gives us another string to our bow to help us meet the priorities of the borough and those affected by coastal erosion." One of the communities that will benefit from the new policy is Hemsby, where villagers have lost 25 homes in the past 11 years. Campaigners are currently fighting for more help from the government after a licence for the 1.3-kilometre rock berm was turned down for government funding due to not enough homes being at risk of being lost to the sea. They are pushing for the criteria to change, arguing that Hemsby is deserving of funding for sea defences due to the resort generating almost £100 million a year for the local economy. The Department for Environment and Rural Affairs has said that it is planning to set up a new resilience task force to tackle coastal erosion and flooding. Staying in Hemsby, the coxswain of Hemsby Independent Lifeboat Service has encouraged families to follow advice to ensure their summer holidays remain fun, relaxing and safe. As the summer season gets into full swing, Hemsby Independent Lifeboat coxswain Daniel Hurd has reminded people to stay vigilant when they enjoy many of Norfolk's beautiful waterways. The lifeboat, which since 1999 has also run an inshore broad rescue service, was recently called to assist with a cruiser stuck on the River Yare after it suffered a major failure. Mr. Hurd said, "While the broads are beautiful, they still pose more of a risk than some people believe. The currents can be incredibly strong and won't leave people much time to react," he said. "And the high weeds under the surface can be a cause for concern. But as long as people make sure they are wearing life jackets, especially their kids and pets, things should be fine. We want people to enjoy our beautiful waterways, both inland and along the coast, and we want to make sure everyone gets home safely at the end of the day." Mr. Hurd said his crew will be on call 24 hours a day, as always, throughout the summer to be there when people need help. The season has provided some respite to the ongoing erosion crisis at Hemsby Beach, and sand has built up along the shore, with more marram grass growing on the cliffs. But Mr. Hurd said the crew and volunteers will still be busy with call-outs, training exercises and of course their annual upcoming Lifeboat Day and Herring Festival. That starts at 4 p.m. on Saturday, August the 10th, and the crew will be hosting their annual foam party with live music from Floating Greyhounds, a licensed bar and sun and fun on the beach. The following day, the Lifeboat Day begins at 9 a.m. The bar will be back open with a barbecue, bouncy castle and fun for the family. It's hoped Great Yarmouth and Goulston RNLI will also make an appearance, showing off their manoeuvres at sea. 2 weeks later, the Herring Festival is also expected to draw a strong crowd from 10 a.m. Daniel added, "Despite the ongoing worry with erosion, the lifeboat is the best it's ever been. We're going from strength to strength and always progressing, and we want to give thanks to everyone who continues to support us." Two men have been found guilty of illegal fox hunting in Norfolk following a three-day trial. Adam Eggington, 23, and Edward Bell, 31, both of Moor Lane in Necton near Swaffham, were found guilty of hunting a wild mammal with dogs at the hearing at Great Yarmouth Magistrates Court. The pair were convicted of the two offences that took place in February 2023. A CCTV video was shown during the trial of the West Norfolk hunt and a pack of 38 dogs in the area of Hingham on February 20th, 2023. The footage captured the moment a fox entered a private garden, followed by a pack of dogs who then, quote, pulled it to pieces before leaving its remains behind. Moments later, an unidentified member of the hunt jumps the fence, removes the fox and hides it under his coat. Bell and Egerton are then seen and heard making efforts to call the dogs back. They eventually regroup and return to the northern side of the road where they had permission to trail hunt. The pair, who denied the charges and were acquitted of two further charges of causing criminal damage and having dogs dangerously out of control, were handed fines and costs totalling £1,700 each. Two others, joint hunt masters Andrew Kendall, 67 of Hulver Road in Henstead, Suffolk, and Robert Gurney, 55 of Borderswell, were cleared of all charges. In a victim's statement, the homeowner described how their property, security and privacy had been violated by the hunt, and how they felt on edge when using their patio for fear of uncontrolled hounds. They revealed that since the incident they had installed additional gates and protection at the home. They added, "Emotionally, it is extremely distressing that we had to clean up the aftermath of the hounds ripping apart a poor lonesome fox on our patio. The hunters left us the pleasure of removing the intestines, kidneys, fox fur and blood from our bloodstained patio. I had to explain this to my three-year-old. Why should she be exposed to this in her home?" The court also heard about an earlier incident involving the same hunt group. On February 8th, 2023, in Tittershall, footage handed to Norfolk Police appeared to show dogs on the trail of a live fox, with Bell and Egerton present and in charge of the dogs. Although trail hunting is legal, in which dogs and riders follow an artificial scent along an agreed route, it has been illegal to hunt foxes in England now for 20 years. After the case, PC Chris Shelley of Norfolk Police's Wildlife Crime Team said, "These two incidents clearly show these dogs intentionally hunting wild mammals in public areas, placing other wild mammals, pets and the wider public at risk because of their behaviour. We presented two cases of illegal hunting which go against the Hunting Act and we hope offers reassurance that Norfolk Constabulary will always deal robustly with such illegal activity."
Well, Andrew will return before you know it. But first, Stephen from Trading Standards has some sage advice.
Hello, I'm Stephen, the Communities Officer for Norfolk County Council Trading Standards. Doorstep cold callers claiming issues with or offering to undertake roofing work. We're warning residents to be aware after reports of roofing rogue traders cold calling at properties in Norfolk. Often in these incidents, the following approaches are being used. The cold caller will offer to clean gutters or fascias, usually quoting a low price of around £20 for the work. Once access to the roof has been given, the cold caller will return to the resident, claim to have found other problems on the roof, like cracked or missing tiles or damaged roof felt. The cold caller will then offer to repair the issues, frequently using claims that water damage will happen if not dealt with immediately. In some incidents, the rogue traders have attempted to charge from a few to several £1,000 for this work. It's also strongly believed that these issues have been caused by the rogue trader while initially on the roof. Another approach reported is a cold caller will claim that they are working nearby or were passing and have seen issues with the property's roof or chimney. Again, the caller will attempt to pressure the homeowner by overstating the risk that these issues pose, but will offer to start repairs straight away, quoting a low price as they're there. Once work has started, further issues are often found, leading to large increases in the initial cost of the work, with the homeowner feeling they must agree as the work has already started. Our advice is never deal with cold callers looking to undertake work on or around your property. Never agree to have work done by someone who's just passing or take their word that it needs to be done at all. Never allow a cold caller access to your home, roof or garden even if they're offering to do tasks for a small fee or free. Never pay for work before it's completed. When looking to have work done on or around your property, only deal with reputable companies you've researched and chosen yourself and obtained a written quotation from before commencing the work. If a cold caller calls at your property, please report it to us through our partners, the Citizens Advice Consumer Helpline, on free phone 0808 223 1133 or report it to Norfolk Police on 101. If you feel intimidated or are concerned for vulnerable neighbours, always call 999. If you'd like one of our free no-call calling door stickers, please request one by calling the Norfolk County Council Customer Service Centre on 0344 800 8020. If you're looking for a trader you can trust, Norfolk Trusted Trader is the only approved trader scheme from Norfolk County Council. It has a directory of more than 200 quality local businesses, from cleaners to carpenters, builders to boiler repair, all approved by Norfolk County Council trading standards. To search our directory and contact a member, visit www.norfolk.gov.uk/trustedtrader or call 0333 444 2196. Staying safe when charging electrical devices. Lithium-ion batteries are rechargeable batteries that can be found in everyday household electrical items like mobile phones, tablets, laptops, vapes, cordless vacuums, power tools, as well as e-bikes, e-scooters and hoverboards. When charging these types of device, follow these simple tips to keep you and others safe. Use the charger supplied with your device. If it breaks, only replace it with one recommended by the manufacturer. Charge your device on a flat, solid surface, never under your pillow. There is a chance it could overheat and catch fire. Charge your device for the recommended charging time and no longer, so it doesn't overheat. Only charge things when you're around and alert. Going out or being asleep means you won't be able to get help quickly if a fire breaks out. Keep devices away from flammable materials, such as aerosols, when they're charging. Make sure to charge and store lithium-ion battery-powered vehicles, such as e-bikes and e-scooters, outside. If this isn't possible, charge them in a closed room away from a main living area and always away from your escape routes, so never in a hallway. And damaged batteries can be a fire risk. Make sure to have them checked regularly.
Up on the roof. When this old world starts getting me down, and people are just too much for me to face, I climb way up to the top of the stairs, and all my cares just drift right into space. On the when I come home feeling tired and weak, I go up where the air is fresh and sweet. I get away from the hustling crowd and all that rat race noise down in the street. On the roof, the only place I know, you can share it all with me. I keep a telling you right smack dab in the middle of town. I found a paradise that's trouble brews. And if this world starts getting you down, there's room enough for two up on the roof. Up on the roof.
The Drifters, up on the roof and not charging a penny. Right, cue Andrew with the second session of this week's local news, followed closely by the story of Galston's Stones.
A bid to build a new supermarket at Caister is gathering momentum, but concerns remain about its impact on traffic. Lidl wants to replace its existing store in the village with a new shop, as well as a restaurant and coffee outlet, on land next to Yarmouth Stadium. The application follows the current store being identified for closure due to it being too small and lacking adequate parking. According to the proposal, all existing staff will be transferred over to the replacement supermarket, which it has been estimated would also create 15 additional jobs. A document submitted with the application says this closure will happen, quote, whether or not planning permission is granted for the new store. So far, the application has received 22 letters of support, with residents saying it will bring jobs to the area. I think this is a brilliant plan to bring Caister to life again, one person said. The bid is also facing objections, however, including one from Norfolk County Council Highways, which has some fundamental concerns. They said a proposed Tukard crossing may not be suitable for a dual carriageway, and that access to the development, as well as its internal layout, needs to be revised. Caister Parish Council is also objecting due to concerns about pedestrians crossing a very busy dual carriageway and inadequate parking. Further documents state that a new Tukan crossing is being proposed to the north of the roundabout. The new store would open at the junction between Yarmouth Road and the Caister Bypass, with access from the adjacent roundabout. The site is 2.6 hectares and currently used as overflow parking for Yarmouth Stadium, with the remainder being grassland. Earlier this month, Norfolk County Council dropped plans to build a little supermarket and 240 houses in Galston. Carrying on a planning theme, an updated bid to build 55 houses in Ormsby St Margaret has not stopped villagers objecting to the plans. The scheme, which is before planners at Great Yarmouth Borough Council, would see the development of land north of Barton Way in the village. The proposed site is owned by the Hurst family, who run the local farm shop and the family fun park, while the development would be built and managed by Flagship Homes. A meeting of Ormsby with Scrapby Parish Council on July the 8th heard the main concerns among villagers were, quote, the strain this would put on existing resources such as medical, education and traffic safety, as well as the impact on wildlife. The plans were first submitted in July last year and soon received more than 300 objections from residents. In December, in response to comments from the Borough Council's strategic planner and Norfolk County Council Highways, the applicant made revisions to the layout of the proposed estate as well as its roads and footpaths. The amendments, however, have failed to stem the tide of opposition, with some villagers renewing their objections to the plans and others sending in fresh objections. One person said, I don't expect Ormsby as a village to always remain unchanged, but not all changes are for the best. Meanwhile, Anglia Water said that desktop analysis suggested the proposed development will lead to, quote, an unacceptable risk of flooding downstream. The estate would have 28 open market, 7 shared ownership and 20 affordable rent houses with access of Barton Way, which is currently a cul-de-sac. Previously, Richard Hurst, whose family owns the land of the proposed development site, said his family had been in the village for more than 70 years and did not want to have a development they were not happy with. A decision on the bid is expected by July the 31st. Great Yarmouth Borough Council has agreed to target five key issues that need improving in the Norfolk town through a £20 million scheme. The council is to submit a bid to the government that outlines a pipeline of five projects it will target through a decade-long project. This includes schemes to improve access to health services, tidy up the town, tackle zombie shops plaguing the high street, improve the lives of children, and work to make the town feel safer. While the long-term investment is welcomed by members, a senior councillor believes it, quote, pales into insignificance to the huge budget cuts the council has faced to its revenue funding. Trevor Wainwright, leader of the Labour opposition group at the Conservative-controlled council, said, "We will be able to use it on a number of areas where previous funding has often been ring-fenced for certain projects, which gives us more flexibility. But it pales into insignificance to the severe funding cuts we've had in the last 14 years. If approved, the authority will begin delivering its programme of action to address these problem areas, which have been identified through a public consultation. Ideas put forward include creating a dentistry training hub at the place, that's the community centre now being created in the former Palmer's department store. Other ideas include funding for more enforcement action to tackle fly tipping, attracting new businesses to fill these empty shops on the high street, and installing more CCTV cameras to provide better surveillance in crime hotspots." Carl Smith, leader of the council, believes the fund will help support his administration's long-term vision for Great Yarmouth, which aims to change people's perception of the town. However, this next story doesn't exactly help us. Bin inspectors could soon be doing the rounds in Great Yarmouth after the borough was deemed among the worst in Norfolk for recycling contamination. Inspectors are set to help people up to scratch. A report in the issue said misuse of communal bins, entrenched poor behaviour and confusion over what can and can't be recycled were partly to blame. As part of a proposed recycling improvement plan, the council recently trialled inspectors visiting areas in Belton and Bradwell, lifting the lid of each bin. If significant contamination was found inside, the resident was issued a letter, and if they received three letters over 6 months, an environmental ranger would visit to educate them. The final sanction would be to remove the recycling bin, however, only be a last resort. Despite stating, quote, "the trial has yet to deliver the improvements we expected," the council's environment and sustainability team has recommended the trial be extended, with a new round added every 2 months. And this comes 1 month after Norfolk County Council proposed to shut all of Norfolk's recycling centres one day a week. Norfolk has reached a milestone as the number of refugees helped to build new lives in the county since 2017 has topped 500. The majority of the 501 resettled with help from Norfolk County Council's People from Abroad team had fled persecution in Syria and Afghanistan, and 276 of those were children at the time when they arrived in the United Kingdom. Alison Thomas, the Conservative-controlled Council's Cabinet Member for Adult Social Care, said, "In the UK, we are lucky to live in safety and be free to go about our business, regardless of the circumstances of our birth or our political opinions. It's vital we don't forget that for some people in the world, that simple freedom is denied, and that some people are forced to flee their homes by violence and persecution. I never cease to be amazed by the huge amount of work our teams do to ensure those who arrive in this country have the best start possible." Brian Watkins, leader of the opposition Liberal Democrat group, said, "It is a testament to our county's willingness to step up when needed." The refugees have settled in Norfolk since the opening of the Syrian Vulnerable Persons Scheme in February 2017, which was subsequently incorporated into the government's UK resettlement scheme, which continues to support refugees coming to the UK. The council said 50% of the refugees were from Syria, 40% from Afghanistan, and the others from a variety of other countries. The figures reflect the number of refugees resettled in Norfolk and do not include those who do not legally hold refugee status, such as people seeking asylum or the 623 Ukrainians currently hosted in Norfolk under the Homes for Ukraine scheme. The work supporting these refugees is funded by the UK government as part of these schemes and carried out by Norfolk County Council with all seven district, borough and city councils and health and voluntary sector partners. The Bishop of Norwich, the Right Reverend Graham Usher, said, "Norfolk County Council's Peoples from Abroad team has a strong reputation for their compassion and care for the refugees they resettle. The individuals resettled in Norfolk were referred to the United Kingdom by the United Nations High Commission for Refugees. People are invited to make donations to help people build their new lives. Details are at www.norfolk.gov.uk/article/43939/help-support-refugee-resettlement. A new sculpture trail honouring hard-working builders has been unveiled in Great Yarmouth. The Mayor of Great Yarmouth, Paula Waters Bunn, officially opened a cultural trail at the Venetian Waterways that celebrates the men who built it. The trail was commissioned by the regional charity Access Community Trust, which oversees the upkeep of the public seafront park. The sculptures celebrate the 127 men who constructed the waterways by hand almost a century ago as a post-war employment scheme. During her unveiled speech, the mayor said, "This trail is a testament to the spirit and tenacity of the people who shaped the Venetian waterways nearly a century ago. It's a tribute to their hard work and a celebration of our rich heritage." Entrepreneur and artist Badge Hopkins designed and crafted the 3 6-foot-high steel sculptures. The artist, known for his evocative and historical pieces, expressed appreciation for the opportunity. He said, "Creating this trail has been a profound journey. It's an honour to bring the stories of these men to life and to contribute to the cultural fabric of Great Yarmouth. I hope this trail inspires reflection and appreciation for our shared history." The Venetian Waterways is a popular site for locals and tourists alike, offering tranquility and beautiful natural surroundings. It is said the new sculpture trail is expected to add a fresh educational and emotional dimension to the area. And visitors can learn more about the sculptures with informative leaflets available from the Island Cafe at the north end of the gardens. Further details about the attraction can be accessed at the Venetian Waterways website or by visiting the Island at the Waterways on Facebook. An official sculpture trail launch video is also available to view online. The search for a hero who went missing off the Norfolk coast after saving the lives of two people is the focus of a new Channel 4 series. George Johnson vanished in 1984 while on a family holiday in Hopton after he selflessly entered the sea to help a family in distress, but was tragically never seen again. On August the 30th of that year, Mr. Johnson had swum from the shore to help a pair who were in difficulty in a dinghy. During the rescue, he was lost and never seen again. A full search was made by coast guards, lifeboats and an RAF helicopter, but to no avail. Now his disappearance will feature in episode 1 of The Body Detectives, a new true crime documentary series. It follows the work of Locate International, an organisation led by ex-detective Dave Grimstead, dedicated to revisiting these forgotten cases and giving a name and a story to each unidentified person. The family of the missing hero, who hailed from Baldock in Hertfordshire, seek his help to try and find his final resting place. It is a journey that takes the programme's team in unexpected directions and across the sea to France as they enlist the help of a pathologist, a forensic oceanographer and an expert in facial reconstruction. Body Detectives aired on July the 23rd on 9 p.m. on Channel 4, but I'm sure will be available on Catch Up. A 17-year-old who had everything to live for sent cryptic text messages about being involved in a crash moments before he collided with trees, a court had heard. Charles Bennington of Mill Road, Blowfield, had been driving his distinctive blue Isuzu Trooper when it crashed on Pedham Road in nearby Hemlington last year. The incident happened at around 8 p.m. on February the 28th, and Mr. Bennington, an apprentice in the oil and gas industry, was declared dead at the scene the following morning on March the 1st. Several statements were read out to Norfolk Coroner's Court during an inquest into his death on July the 22nd. From the evidence, it was clear that the tragedy had left his loved ones in widespread shock, and many are still coming to terms with his passing. None more than his parents, Paul and Jane Bennington, who attended the court, County Hall in Norwich, in person. Sitting with extended members of their family, Mrs. Bennington placed a framed photograph of her son in front of the area coroner, Yvonne Blake. A police forensic report heard that in the minutes prior to the crash, Mr. Bennington sent messages to two friends informing them that he had been in a car crash. He also watched videos on his phone about the possibility of death by driving and crashing at speed. PC Jamie Hutchin, a forensic collision investigator who compiled the report, confirmed that the teen had been driving without his seatbelt on, and although within the speed limit, he had shown no indication of braking or swerving to avoid a collision. Recording a verdict of suicide, coroner Mrs. Blake said, "On the balance of probabilities, it was more likely than not that it was a deliberate act." She said, "The evidence from the pathologist is that Charles would not have been able to send those messages after the crash because of his very severe injuries, his position in the car, and the phone's position in the car. I have no idea, and neither does anyone else apparently, of why he would do it, which is what makes it all the more distressing that nobody has any idea. But all the evidence is that he was a lovely, well-liked man, much older than his years. No one had a bad word to say about him. He was obviously going to be a very successful man. He had everything to look forward to." She added, "He was only 17, and young people's brains do not really mature emotionally until around 25, and they are prone to impulsivity and do not learn to regulate emotionally. The conclusion must be one of suicide. I'm very sorry, it's a horrible thing to hear, all the more painful because no one seems to have any knowledge as to why. In 20 years of doing this, I've never heard so many really nice statements about such a nice man in all my career. I've never heard anything like it." Mrs. Bennington said that while the family were, quote, sorry with the conclusion, they understood why the coroner had reached it. His family statement said, "Charles was the most treasured gift of a child and young man. He brought us such joy, love, inspiration and happiness. Although only 17, he inspired love and kindness and respect to all, living life to the full. Charles loved working for H.G. Wells Intervention Oil Services, undertaking his apprenticeship role with a zest of inspiration, achievement, intellect, capability and ambition. He worked hard and he also loved his Saturday job in a jewellery shop in Norwich, where he was regarded as having an extraordinary knowledge and passion for collecting coins and watches. He'd spoken to us of his plans for a focused future in his chosen career and was looking forward to holiday with friends in October. To quote a friend of Charles, 'I miss that boy so much. Anything he touched turned to gold, and anyone he spoke to smiled in an instant. Charles was such a wonderful part of our lives, and we would miss him every minute of the day and night. We thank friends, family, and our family's village for the loving support they continue to give us in our greatest sorrow. We also thank everyone who donated through GoFundMe, thus enabling the yearly awards in Charles's name and providing memorial benches at Heathlands and Blowfield Heath. We love and miss Charles so, and always will forever in our hearts and mind. In Charles's memory, the family have created, in partnership with Eastern College and H.G. Wells Services, a yearly award called the Charles Bennington Achievement Award in Engineering and Heavy Machinery. His parents are also supporting the Kindness Cup yearly award in Charles's name at their local primary school, which he attended."
Thanks, Andrew. More news shortly, but first, here's a piece which piqued my interest. Question: could Galston have once been Norfolk's answer to Stonehenge, complete with a stone circle used for ancient worship? Allegedly, they were the stones that put the Stone into Galston, forming a spectacular stone circle that once greeted the sunrise in the seaside town. Where Stone Close now stands, it's said that a stone circle, the only one of its kind known in East Anglia, once towered over the land with 10 huge stones, like unto those of Stonehenge. Now covered with a housing estate, the stones that once drew crowds were known as the Gull Stones, and were, according to legend, a magnet to druids who would gather there in June to watch the midsummer sun's spectacular rise over the North Sea. Charles Palmer, who was twice mayor of the borough, chief magistrate for Yarmouth and deputy lieutenant for Suffolk, published a number of literary works on the town and its surrounding area. In 1875 he wrote, "There is a tradition that the Druids had a temple at Galston, some remains of which existed down to a comparatively recent period. It's supposed to have stood on a field next to the road to Lowestoft upon what is called Great Stone Close, and it has been asserted that some huge stones remained standing until 1768, when they were destroyed by digging round their base and dragging them down by ropes." Yeah, that would do it. There are two fields also called Furtherstone Close and Middlestone Close. So that it is possible that the druidical circles may have had a wide extent. Middlestone Close in Galston still exists, but Furtherstone Close has been replaced by the somewhat less mystical A12 Inner Relief Road. The stones that were toppled were said to have been dragged to the harbour, where they formed the first stone pier that greeted sailors as they arrived to the town. At a meeting of the Yarmouth branch of the Norfolk and Norwich Archaeological Society in 1888, a painting of the Gull Stones was displayed, then in the possession of Fred Danby Palmer. Yes, one of those Palmers, I think. Norfolk Heritage Explorer adds an element of doubt to the story, saying that a letter written in 1925, which has mysteriously gone missing, says that the evidence for a stone circle is very flimsy and there is a suspicion of forgery. It also says, however, that as there is no large house anywhere near in which they could have formed a garden ornament, an antiquarian folly seems improbable. Archaeological evidence suggests that stone circles were used as places for burial and ritual, linked to agricultural events such as the summer solstice. Many are aligned to either the sun or the moon, and together form a kind of calendar, revealing the level of engineering and geometry skills that ancient civilizations possessed. There are around 1,250 stone circles in Britain and Ireland, with the largest number in Scotland, which has 508 recorded sites. Of the 316 in England, the vast majority are in the southwest of the country, which would make a possible circle in Galston a real rarity. So, was Galston a gathering place for druids? Perhaps used as a seaside treat after spending most of their time on Salisbury Plain. After all, a few pints of mead and a plate of herring along the seafront would be a luxury in those days. Well, probably not, as the evidence of both its existence and its destruction in 1768 seems to lead back to a certain Galston writer called W.E. Randall, who, in the early 19th century, was apparently famous, or should that be infamous, for forging antiquarian documentation to further his ambitions, which seemed to be creating notable histories which could be attributed to Galston. Why should that be? Well, as far as my short research shows, that's not known, although a clue may lie in the fact that he was proprietor and editor of the Galston and South Town News. In the days before photography and the ability or even the remotest possibility of drawing sales from scantily clad ladies, getting something to increase sales would leave him only with options such as black and white drawings of the death of Nelson, accompanying, at a stretch, one or two days' worth of relevant prose. After all, once you've said, Admiral Nelson dies in shooting drama, gets kissed by the captain and shoved in a barrel of rum to avoid any smell, the options are limited. Whereas a nice juicy story about Druids on the Lowestoft Road, being an exclusive, could be stretched out ad infinitum. But hey, am I not doing a Randall myself? OK, let's just say that it does make an extremely good story. Another of those pieces from our COVID online only period, followed by the Electric Light Orchestra turning to stone. Well, the rest of this week's local news is now revealed in all its monophonic glory as we return to Andrew.
Part of the A47 was closed after a car crash left one vehicle on its roof. Police were called to the Halfrees roundabout in Great Yarmouth at 7:28 p.m. on Tuesday, following reports of a two-vehicle collision. One car flipped onto its roof in the crash. The road was closed while emergency services, including fire and ambulance crews, attended the scene. The extent of any injuries remains unknown, but the East of England Ambulance Service has been contacted by the Mercury for comment, and the road reopened just after 10:30 p.m. A family have spoken of their shock after their loved one lost almost 2 stone in 2 weeks during a temporary stay at a care home just days before her death. Patricia Slaughter went to Ritson Lodge Care Home in Great Yarmouth for a fortnight while her daughters, who care for her, went on holiday. But when her family went to collect her, they said they couldn't recognise their loved one because of how her health had deteriorated. She died just days later, and an inquest into her death has heard evidence of how her condition had gone dramatically downhill during her stay. Jacqueline Lake, the coroner, heard that Mrs. Slaughter lost 12 kilogram, almost 2 stone, while at the home. A statement read by the family said that when they dropped Mrs. Slaughter off on June 5th, 2023, she could walk on her own with the help of a stick and could speak well. But when they collected her on June the 23rd, she was in a wheelchair and unable to speak. Shortly after returning home, she became severely dehydrated and suffering from kidney damage and was taken to hospital the following day. The retired worker died on June the 30th, 2023, at the James Paget Hospital in Galston. Her inquest heard that care facility had made numerous errors in keeping track of Mrs. Slaughter's medical records, mainly notes of her food and fluid intake. Some days the notes on the food and fluid consumption were not completed or were incorrectly filled in. Mrs. Slaughter's family had left some of her favourite biscotti biscuits and Bailey's Irish cream with her, but staff had not given these to her as it was against the home's policy. A medical practitioner at the hospital gave the medical cause of death as enhanced dementia, hypertension, frailty and concerns of neglect at the Ritson Lodge care home. A post-mortem analysis gave the cause of death as pneumonia. With the conflicting conclusions, the coroner heard evidence from the care facility manager and the family before summarising. Siobhan Fennell, the care home manager, argued that, quote, care had been provided, and said that Mrs. Slaughter was a reluctant patient because she wanted to go home, which made it difficult for her staff. Mrs. Lake concluded there was not sufficient gross neglect to formally give neglect as the cause of death. She said she did not hear evidence that the lack of fluid and food intake of Mrs. Slaughter was raised to medical professionals. Recording a narrative conclusion, she said, Mrs. Slaughter died from pneumonia. She was acutely dehydrated when she entered the hospital. In the period immediately before this, her intake of food and fluids was poor. This was not always monitored or escalated by the care home. Mrs. Lake was satisfied that the care home, by adopting a new electronic system to monitor the recording of patients' food and fluid intake, had made changes to prevent further and similar deaths. Though the medical cause of death was not issued as neglect, the family, speaking after the inquest, expressed anger at the decision. They said Pat was a lovely, smart, tidy and caring person. She was a great grandmother, grandmother and a mother. She was always smiley and always playful, with the best interests of everyone else always taking priority before her own wishes. But we are very disappointed by the official cause of death decision because we feel that there was more than enough evidence of neglect heard that contributed to Pat's death. She was unrecognisable when we picked her up, and we really struggle to accept this verdict, the family said. Now some entertainment returning to the area over the summer. Two varying types as well. Weekly summertime fireworks in Hemsby and Great Yarmouth have begun for another new year. The Big Tuesdays in Hemsby and the Big Wednesdays in Great Yarmouth are back this week, lighting up the skies off the East Coast. Running over 6 weeks, street acts including a Britain's Got Talent semi-finalist will entertain the crowds before the aerial displays start at 10 p.m. On week 3, Titan the Robot will also be making an appearance. The Robot will arrive in Hemsby on August the 6th, before returning to Great Yarmouth a day later, after wowing crowds earlier this year at the Wheels Festival last month. Lyndon Bevan, chair of Visit Great Yarmouth, said, People always look forward to our fireworks starting and travel from far and wide to make sure they catch them, planning their visits around the dates. Our firework evenings are huge milestones in our calendar, with day trippers, locals and holiday makers making an evening of it in both locations. Following requests from the public, in week 4, August the 14th, low noise fireworks will be trialled in Great Yarmouth. Now, a popular horror film festival gears up for its third consecutive year with famed participants. Saturday, July the 27th sees the return of the 50 years of classic British horror festival at St George's Theatre in Great Yarmouth. This annual event has been a success since its inception in 2023. Over the past 2 years, it has boasted appearances by horror fan favourites such as director Lawrence Gordon Clark, Sergei Sobotsky, son of legendary Amicus film producer Milton Sobotsky, and the Swedish actor Britt Hägglund. This year's special guest, Carolyn Monroe, is respected in the genre and has appeared in many well-known horror and fantasy films, such as The Golden Voyage of Sinbad, Captain Kronos Vampire Hunter, and also the James Bond movie, The Spy Who Loved Me. Al Friswell, a restorer chosen by Ray Harryhausen for the preservation of monster models used in his films, will talk about his experiences with the master animator. Screenwriter David McGillivray, known primarily for his work on exploitation horror films like Frightmare and House of Whipcord, will also be participating. Rejoining the festivals are favourites like Madeline Smith, who appears in the Hammer film Frankenstein and A Monster from Hell, and Phil Campbell and Brian Reynolds. The festival also promises to present Pareidolia, a modern horror thriller featuring Graham Cole, aka PC Tony Stamp of The Bill. The festival organiser, Celine Paxton Brooks, said, "St George's Theatre continues to be a great venue to show much-loved horror films. Now into its third year, 50 years of classic British horror has become a popular annual event. It's wonderful to bring vintage movies like Frankenstein and A Monster from Hell, as well as guests from in front of and behind the camera, to enthusiasts in Norfolk who might not always get the chance to experience events like this. And if you're brave enough, tickets are still available for purchase at St George's Theatre." A group of young men were spoken to by police after a complaint was made about them skinny dipping in the Norfolk Broads. Officers were called to Potterheim to report a group of young men swimming naked in the River Thurne. Police arrived at the scene and spoke to the individuals involved. However, no crime was recorded and no further action was taken. The incident happened at around 6:30 p.m. on June the 25th and was later discussed at a Potterheim Parish Council meeting. The parish clerk read a report submitted by PC Pretty stating that the village had made 18 calls to the police over the previous 10 weeks. Issues reported included a stolen vehicle, a caravan burglary and the incident of skinny dipping. It's not the first time Norfolk has seen complaints such as this. Back in 1890, the Cromer and North Walsham Post reported on fishermen who lamented men and women, quote, "stripping themselves of every shred of clothing and entering the water in a state of complete nudity." In England and Wales, being naked in public is not an offence unless it can be proven the person disrobed with the intention of causing distress or shock. A knifeman stabbed a 23-year-old to death on a busy street in a revenge killing following an early attack, a court has heard. Junior Silomane, aged 22, is accused of the murder of Felicio Jose Vieira Balde following a chance encounter in St Peter's Road in Yarmouth in February of 2023. Norwich Crown Court was told he had pulled out a large knife to inflict fatal injuries with a single stab wound to the chest, as revenge for an attack he had suffered a month earlier. Mr. Vieira Balde, a factory worker who was living at the Elstow Hotel off Stanley Terrace, died in a nearby alleyway after staggering away from the broad daylight attack with unsurvivable injuries. Suleiman of Marketplace, Yarmouth, was arrested 2 days later in Leeds after attempting to evade arrest by fleeing via Cambridge and London. He denies murder, with the court told he claims to have been acting in self-defence. Will Carter, prosecuting, said the spur-of-the-moment attack had been quite simply a revenge killing. After an unexpected encounter with someone he accused of having previously stabbed him to the top of his leg. A jury of 7 men and 5 women was shown CCTV of Suleiman leaving a Londis shop after buying cigarettes and seeing Mr. Vieira Balde walking past. The graphic footage showed him removing a large knife from a backpack and walking towards Vieira Balde before striking him. The victim staggered back, clutching his chest, and although the stabbing had fatally wounded him, he managed to run away to an alley where he collapsed, said Mr. Carter. 2 women, who called 999, had seen him staggering down neighbouring Wellington Road moments after the attack. He seemed to be spitting, but he was in fact coughing up blood, said Mr. Carter. Life-saving attempts by a first aider from a nearby firm had proved unsuccessful after he was found lying close to death outside the property of a friend, he added. Following the attack, the CCTV footage showed Suleiman and his uncle, James Santos, leaving the scene. The court was told 5 minutes later they were captured on another camera, entering the rented flat on Marine Parade, before leaving 20 minutes later, with Suleiman having changed clothes and Santos carrying a bin bag. They had then been seen walking onto Yarmouth Beach towards the sea, out of sight of the cameras, before heading through sand dunes. The prosecution says the knife and the clothing was in the bag they had. Neither have ever been recovered, and we say it was discarded somewhere in the sea or on the beach, said Mr. Carter. 2 hours after the attack, the 2 men had been picked up by taxi from the Haven Seashore Holiday Park in North Deans and taken to Loddon as part of a convoluted attempt to get away, the court heard. From Loddon, they had gone to the Stour Grange Hotel in Drayton, but had left in the early hours of the following morning, heading to North Walsham, before taking a taxi to Cambridge, where they checked into a guest house. They then travelled to London and took a coach from Victoria Coach Station to Leeds. Both were arrested when police boarded the coach when it arrived at a Leeds bus station at 8:10 p.m. In a prepared statement following his arrest, Suleiman admitted to police that he had walked towards Mr. Vieira Balde with the knife and made a jabbing motion, but denied that he intended to kill him. The trial continues.
Well, that's it for this week's edition, which is copyright 2024 of the Great Yarmouth and District Talking Newspaper Association. News content is adapted mainly from the Great Yarmouth Mercury. However, the Great Yarmouth and District Talking Newspaper Association accepts responsibility for editorial decisions made for this recording. Don't forget, you can contact us from our website at grapevinegy.org if you have any queries over our service. Your newsreader next week will be Desney. So we hope for your company then for much more of your local news. In the meantime, from all that's Grapevine, stay safe and well, enjoy our brief glimpse of summer, and bye for now.